He was driven by, he was obsessed by a desire for the Jews to regain their place in the world.
In this second lecture, we're going to meet Theodor Herzl in some detail. I think you're going to help us see some of the unique characteristics that make up the man. Can you share some of those with us?
He did have unique characteristics without which it's hard to imagine him being the founder of the Jewish state. First one is ambition. He grew up wanting to do something great. When he was 10 years old and the Suez Canal was completed by de Lesseps, he wanted to do the same thing, cutting a canal through the Isthmus of Panama. He wanted to scale the heights of the literary world by writing plays that would be produced at the finest theaters in Vienna and Berlin. He wanted to become a writer of a feuilleton, a particular genre that started in France and moved to German-speaking Europe, and that was really considered the pinnacle of writing for newspapers on cultural affairs. He wanted to be a world historical figure. He wanted to do great things. He wanted his parents, with whom he was very, very close, to be proud that he had done something great. So ambition is number one. Second, he was somebody with a tremendous work ethic. He worked incredibly hard, day in and day out, very productive as a writer. I mean, if you just look at the sheer volume of what he produced, it's awe-inspiring. And he did it by dint not only of talent, but of very hard work. Third thing, for better and for worse, he had something of a manic personality. And that meant that he could have a moment in which he would get focused on something, and then for a few weeks, he would just be productive, even beyond his normal, very high standard. So a particular moment that comes to mind, he was posing for a sculptor. And they were discussing the Jewish problem and the fact that there was this taint of money that was very much a feeder of anti-Semitism. But even if you're an artist, you couldn't escape that taint. Well, by the time Herzl had walked a short distance away from that posing session, an entire play had formed itself in his head, and over the next 17 days, working morning, noon, and night, he wrote that play. That kind of behavior, that intensity, was to characterize him throughout his Zionist leadership career. The last aspect of his character that I think is very important is he had a deep sense of honor. He was driven by, he was obsessed by a desire for the Jews to regain their place in the world. He was devastated by anti-Semitism, whether in its more brutal physical forms or in its more subtle cultural forms or in its economic manifestations. And that desire to right this wrong is ultimately what drove him as a leader. And by the way, if you look at great leaders, they're fueled not only by something they love, by a passion, but there's something they hate, something they just can't bear seeing in the world. And they have to use every ounce of strength they have and every moment of time they can garner in order to right that wrong. That was Herzl.
Was Herzl a religious man?
Herzl was not a observant religious Jew in the sense that he didn't wake up each morning and say the prayer that the Jewish legal texts say you're supposed to say on waking in the morning, and he didn't go to the synagogue on a regular basis and didn't observe the Sabbath in a traditional way. But he was a deeply passionate Jew. He's somebody who believed in Jewish peoplehood. He actually had great regard for the rabbis. He's somebody who not only loved his people, but wanted to see his people restored to Zion, to their traditional homeland. He was a passionate believer in the Exodus story, actually tried to learn lessons from Moses and from some of the opposition that Moses faced. He wrote a beautiful, beautiful essay called The Menorah, which was about his own return to Judaism and about the symbolism of the Hanukkah menorah that's lit with its eight candles, and especially with the shamash, the servant candle. So he is somebody who not only had a powerful Jewish instinct, but that powerful Jewish instinct grew over time. He said famously that Zionism is a return to Judaism before anything else, and he himself embodied that return to Judaism.
With that, let's turn to the second lecture.
In our first lecture, we spoke about the fateful and absolutely fascinating meeting in June of 1895 between Baron Maurice de Hirsch, the great businessman, banker, railway magnate, and Jewish philanthropist, and a young Theodor Herzl, journalist and writer. Herzl described this as the confrontation between the big Jew of money on the one hand and himself, the Jew of the spirit, on the other. However you might want to describe it, it was not a successful meeting if success is defined in Herzl's terms of bringing Baron Hirsch on board with his plans for launching a Jewish state. But it was extraordinarily successful in terms of the processes that it set off within Herzl himself. And it's no accident that he refers to this day and this meeting as the beginning of his career as a Zionist leader. The earlier lecture was devoted in large part to talking about the three challenges that faced Herzl or anybody else at that time who would have dared to dream of launching a Jewish state. There was the intellectual challenge, which was to say persuading Jews that it was both worthwhile as well as feasible to establish a Jewish state. There was the political challenge, a challenge based on the need for Herzl both to assert his own leadership, but also to build a movement around institutions, institutions that could galvanize the Jewish world across many, many countries, institutions that could last for the decades that Herzl and everybody else who thought about this knew would be necessary in order for this movement to have a chance to succeed. The third challenge was diplomatic. The Ottoman Empire, although a crumbling empire called the sick man of Europe, nonetheless held on to large swaths of territory, including Palestine, the land of Israel. And it was necessary either to persuade the Sultan, the leader of that Ottoman Empire, that he in fact was willing to, perhaps even interested in, allowing Jews to settle there in large numbers and begin to build the foundations for their national state. And failing that, it would be necessary to persuade one of the three great powers, the great empires, the Russian Empire, the German Empire, or the British Empire, that they wanted to put a lot of their own clout behind persuading the Ottomans to allow the formation of a Jewish state, and barring that, getting one of those empires to decide that it would like to replace the Ottomans in due time, and when doing so, build a Jewish state in the historic land of the Jews. Those were the challenges that anybody in Herzl's shoes would have faced as of June of 1895. But in order to appreciate, to really understand Herzl's leadership, we need to see what he personally brought to the table. Because he, as the leader of this movement, would be very different from Baron Hirsch and would be very different from a traditional rabbi from Russia or anybody else who was to take this task upon himself. And so what we're going to do in today's lecture is to really look at Herzl, to take stock of him at age 35 as he's about to embark on a international crusade, one that would last for 9 years until his premature death at age 44. What we're going to do is begin with a sketch of his life in order to make sense chronologically of who he was and where he had been. From there, we're going to consider four key assets, four key areas that he brought with him to this challenge. The first of them is his Jewish experience and attitudes. Second one has to do with his own education and experiences, the things he learned, the things he knew how to do as he stepped forward as a leader. The third is his character traits, both those that were helpful to a would-be leader and those that potentially could set him back. And finally, we're going to look at other assets that he had based on his personal circumstances that actually made him quite well suited for the task at hand. Now, in this lecture, I'm going to base myself very significantly, as I will for the succeeding lectures, on Herzl's own writings, especially his diaries, of course, his canonical work, The Jewish State, his essays, and later on, Altneuland as well. But I'm also relying on the many fine biographers who have written about Herzl. Alex Bein in particular, along with Amos Alon, Stephen Beller and Shlomo Avineri, but above all of them, I'll be relying on the ideas and perspectives of my longtime colleague, Yoram Chazoni, who wrote about Herzl, I think, compellingly in his own book called The Jewish State and in a series of essays that he published. So without further ado, let's travel now to Pest, the year 1860, when Herzl is born. Pest is part of what later becomes Budapest, in the kingdom of what was then Hungary. He was born to devoted, cultured, well-to-do parents, Jacob and Jeanette Herzl. His father was a very successful businessman. His mother had significant literary interests and was in particular a Germanophile. Herzl recalls that not a day went by in which she didn't read from one of the classics of German literature. At this period, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was beginning to form, and that in fact happened in 1867. Budapest became the capital of its Hungarian portion, and the city was in a sense riven by conflicts between the Magyars, the Hungarian-speaking nationalists on the one hand, and the Germanophiles, those who loved the German language and culture and people, on the other. The Herzl family clearly belonged to the German faction. They also took a position within the issues facing the Jewish people at the time. And the family belonged to the liberal reform temple that was quite close to Herzl's boyhood home. In that temple, he went with his father to Sabbath services and to holiday services. In that temple, he was also bar mitzvah, or what they called confirmation at the time, at age 13, as was appropriate for a Jewish lad of his rank and station in life. He also went to a Jewish-run school from age 6 to 10, and in fact, in his autobiography written when he was in his late 30s, he describes having been beaten for having not remembered sufficiently well the details of the exodus from Egypt. And he notes at that point that there were plenty of rabbis, once he became a committed Zionist, who would prefer to beat him for having remembered those details all too well and having acted upon them. Be that as may, when he was about 10 years old, he developed a fascination with technology and an ambition to do great things. This was the time when the Suez Canal had been successfully completed under de Lesseps, and Herzl had this dream, which he shared with his parents, that he was going to do the same thing, the cutting through of a narrow strip of land, of an isthmus, in order to build a canal in Panama. And he was going to go on to be a great historical figure. His parents, I would say to their credit, took his idea seriously and enrolled him in a school that focused on scientific and technical subjects because they recognized his love for technology. However, Herzl wasn't so much bound up in that earlier love, and within a few years had fallen in love with the humanities. And he became interested in literature and writing. He formed a literary club, naturally became its founding president, and had a rule in the Constitution that the founding president couldn't be removed for at least the first 10 meetings. Already then he had a sense of how to build organizations. While he was becoming less interested in the scientific subjects in the school and reflecting that in his performance, the school was becoming more anti-Semitic, as reflected both in the behavior of the students, but also the teachers. And according to Herzl, what was the last straw for him was when one of the teachers explained the word heathens by saying, "Among them are the idolaters, the Mohammedans, and the Jews." That and whatever else was happening in the school and Herzl's burgeoning interests in literature and history were enough to persuade him and his parents to enroll him in a gymnasium. In fact, it was called the Evangelical Gymnasium, which was obviously of Christian origins, but the majority of the students there were Jewish. And in that school, they followed the tradition of the elite gymnasium high schools throughout the German-speaking world, and the emphasis was on classical languages, classical texts, literature, history, mathematics, and so on. And here, Herzl absolutely was thriving. He learned within a year Latin and Greek, He added them to the German and Hungarian that he already spoke on a native level, and he began an explosive output of writing. Essays, poems, book and theater reviews. He even had some of his pieces at a rather young age published in a well-regarded Budapest newspaper. His family throughout this remained quite close-knit, and that's why it was an extraordinary blow when his only sibling, his older sister Pauline, died suddenly, unexpectedly, of typhus when he was only 17 years old. As distraught as he was, his mother was more distraught. She literally couldn't bear to look on the house in which she had raised her daughter and the streets on which she and her daughter had walked. And so on 1 week's notice, the family picked up and moved from Budapest to Vienna. And in the process, moved from a Hungarian area into an area that was the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the center of its German-speaking population, and in many respects, the intellectual center of all of Europe. Herzl decided at this point that he wanted to make his career as a writer. His parents at this point decided that it would be good if he might be able to make a living someday, a typical argument that I think we're all familiar with. And so the compromise was that he would enroll in law school at the University of Vienna. And at that university develop, over the course of many years, a profession that he could practice were he to choose to do so. So he enrolled there, but in point of fact, he turned it into effectively a liberal arts college for himself. And in addition to studying what he had to study in law, where his particular love was Roman law, he studied philosophy of law and philosophy of history. He studied history, he studied literature, he went to all kinds of lectures in the evening. He joined the Student Cultural Association and quickly became one of the leaders there, running literary evenings, speaking publicly in ways that people remembered and wrote about many years later, became a debater, did all of the things that one does in such a club, until rather suddenly it was shut down. And it was shut down for a reason that a lot of things were coming to a halt, or at least sources of tension in Vienna at that time, and that had to do with the rise of nationalism, especially German nationalism, and the concurrent rise of anti-Semitism. The Student Cultural Association invited a national speaker who happened to be a prominent politician and anti-Semite, and he came and delivered what one might have expected, which was an anti-Semitic speech. And in reaction, the university shut down this cultural center, leaving young Theodor Herzl at about age 21 with the decision how he wanted to develop himself culturally and socially. And he chose to join a fraternity. Not just any fraternity, though. He chose to join the Albia Dueling Fraternity, something that at the time was quite standard for people of his age and station. And when they said dueling fraternity, they meant it. For 4 hours a day, on top of their schoolwork, cultural activities, and whatever else the students there did, they trained in fencing. And in fact, he took private lessons in fencing to make sure he was good enough. He fought the obligatory duel that was necessary in order to become a full member, and took great pride in being a part of this fraternity. But he wasn't frittering away his time. In addition to his studies and his dueling, he was also writing, and writing prolifically. His greatest success was in having published what's called a feuilleton. This was originally a French invention, but later taken on not only by French newspapers, but by German newspapers as well. This was the learned, thoughtful essays of travel, of culture, of politics, of life as it was experienced, and experienced with great gusto in Vienna and elsewhere throughout Europe. And Herzl was able to get some of his essays run in leading French and German newspapers, and that alongside writing novels and plays and a host of other genres. He graduated in 1884, 6 years after he began, at age 24, and he practiced law fairly diligently for an entire year until he had had enough of it. He explains what his rationale was, but the bottom line was he was a man born to write. He was a man born with a vision of achieving great things, and he felt that he was constricted by the law. And so his ever-indulgent parents gave him an allowance large enough to allow him to travel throughout Europe. So he went to Belgium and Holland and went to the museums and studied the works of the masters. And he walked out in nature and saw the landscapes. And from there he went on and he traveled to France and he traveled to Germany and he traveled to Italy and he traveled all around Europe learning about the world. And as always, writing. Plays, novels, feuilleton. He actually became successful, meteorically so. And I say this because it is very much in fashion among people who want to criticize Herzl to talk about how unsuccessful he was as a playwright and how he was failed in this and that. In point of fact, within 3 years after starting his writing career, he had conquered the two things that he and others in the cultural elite saw as the pinnacles. One was that he had his plays produced at the very top theaters in the two leading cities, Vienna and Berlin. And shortly afterwards, he had one of his feuilletons published in the very leading newspaper in Austria, some would say the very leading newspaper anywhere in the German-speaking world, the Neue Freie Presse. So he reached the pinnacle, at least the pinnacle as it seemed at the time, around age 28, and within the year, he had married to Julie Naschauer, a beautiful young woman from a very wealthy family, a family wealthier than his own. Within short order, they had two children, and then after a brief delay, they had a third, the first named, of course, for his sister, Pauline, then a son, Hans, and a third daughter, Trude. Unfortunately, his marriage was an unhappy one, which is generally ascribed to the fact that his wife, whatever her virtues were, was a very unstable personality. He loved his children, wrote about them often, wrote to them, but he was often away. And in fact, when he was 31, in 1891, he was posted to Paris as the correspondent for the Neue Freie Presse, an incredibly prestigious post. As we discussed in the first lecture, France was in many ways the political epicenter of Europe, with its 100 years war between republicanism on the one hand and monarchists on the other. And if France was the epicenter, then Paris was the capital of that epicenter. And Herzl, traveling there without his family, was posted in order to share news and analysis of politics, culture, and intellectual life with everyone in the German-speaking world who was reached by the Neue Freie Presse. That's where he was when he ended his 4-year stint in 1895, had that fateful meeting with Baron Hirsch, and went on to begin the Zionist leadership phase of his career. Now, it's important to have all of that as background for what we're now going to do, which is to look carefully at four key elements that Herzl had that brought him strengths and, in a few cases, weaknesses that were relevant for what he could do and what he couldn't do as he stepped into his leadership role. And I want to begin with Herzl's Jewish background and attitudes as the first of those four. And I begin with it because many people, affected by what they've read and what they've heard, are of the belief that, first of all, Herzl was a highly assimilated Jew, barely connected to his people, and second, that this changed almost in an instant at the Dreyfus trial, and in particular, at the degradation of Dreyfus in 1895. And both of these views are quite wrong, and if you go into an appreciation of Herzl starting from those views, it's going to be very difficult to really understand who he was, what he did, and why he did it. So let's begin with, where does this myth come from? So full disclosure, Herzl himself is largely responsible for it. He wrote a number of years later that it was the Dreyfus trial that made him a Zionist, for a host of reasons that is actually not a fair or even plausible representation of what had happened. Herzl wrote it at a particular time for a particular reason, and ever since then, virtually all of his biographers have been at pains to point out, often with painstaking proof, that his Zionism, or his interest in the Jewish question certainly, predated this trial. But beyond what Herzl himself wrote, the reason that this idea of the Dreyfus trial as absolutely central has perpetuated itself is because this was a trial with extraordinary drama. Right? Captain Alfred Dreyfus was a genuinely assimilated Jew. He was a French patriot from a well-to-do family and became a career military officer. He was accused, entirely wrongly, of having betrayed France by selling secrets to Germany, to the German Empire, which of course was the leading enemy of France, having defeated France in the Franco-Prussian War 25 years earlier. Not only was he wrongly accused, he was convicted. And when he was convicted, he declared, "I swear that you have convicted an innocent man. Vive la France!" But that didn't have such an impact because he wasn't believed, at least not initially. Herzl covered the trial and was there for the degradation ceremony, at which he saw an proudly erect Captain Dreyfus standing there in his uniform as he was approached by a representative of the military forces and of the law, who stripped off all of his buttons on his uniform and stripped off all of his cords and took his sword and broke it over the knee. Utter degradation for Dreyfus. But what was worse, from Herzl's point of view, was the crowds. The crowds, led first by the journalists and then by others, chanting first death to the traitor and then death to the Jews. This was indeed something that had an impact on Herzl, but we have to recognize that his interest in Jewish issues stretched throughout his Jewish life. It didn't happen in that moment where the sword broke or where the crowd screamed out death to the Jews. In fact, in his Zionist diaries, which he began keeping around the time of the Hirsch meeting in June 1895, he wrote, "When did I actually begin to concern myself with the Jewish question? Probably ever since it arose, certainly from the time that I read Döring's book." And here he's referring to a book by a great, infamous German writer, Eugen Döring, called The Jewish Problem as a Problem of Race, Morals, and Culture, published in 1881 when Herzl was about 21 years old, a virulently anti-Semitic work, but written in beautiful German, the kind of German that Herzl loved and admired, and with powerful arguments, the kind that Herzl would try to make, albeit not on that side. And so already from age 21, Herzl was, he said, interested. And as he describes it in the diary, "As the years went on, the Jewish question bored into me and gnawed at me, tormented me, and made me very miserable. In fact, I kept coming back to that whenever my own personal experiences, joys and sorrows, permitted me to rise to broader considerations." We also have to understand that he had considerable pride as a Jew, not as one might have thought if one bought the argument that he was a highly assimilated. So you can see this in one of his earlier clashes when he was trying to get one of his works published. And as he describes it, "When as a green young writer I took a manuscript to the Vienna Deutsche Volkenschrift, Dr. Friedgung advised me to adopt a pen name less Jewish than my own." Herzl apparently was too much of a giveaway. And Herzl writes, "I flatly refused, saying that I wanted to continue to bear the name of my father, and I offered to withdraw the manuscript. Friedung accepted it anyway." Right? His pride came from his pride in his parents, in his family, in his name, in the simplest things, and he was willing to give up something of enormous significance, the chance to be published in this significant publication. As it happens, his pride paid off, and it was published under his name. But the more dramatic story that shows Herzl's pride in his Judaism comes from his dueling fraternity days at Albia. In February of 1883, when he had been in the fraternity for perhaps a year and a half, the great anti-Semitic composer Richard Wagner, whom I should add, Herzl absolutely adored in terms of his music while despising his politics, that Wagner passed away, and a memorial was held in Vienna, co-sponsored by a number of fraternities, including Albia. It took place March 5th, 1883, and the climax of this memorial for Wagner was when Hermann Bahr, a representative of Albia, strode up to the platform and gave a rousing speech in which he declared himself a convert to Wagnerian anti-Semitism and a convert to the pan-German anti-Semitic movement. This brought the house down, which in turn brought the police in, who in turn stopped the event at that moment, leading to diverse reactions. The university senate censured Hermann Bahr for having given the speech, and his brethren in Albia made him a hero. 2 days later, Theodor Herzl, the young man who adored this fraternity, had invested hundreds if not thousands of hours in it, and was proud to be a member, wrote the following letter to his fraternity. During that celebration, matters developed into an anti-Semitic demonstration. I have not seen in the newspapers which reported about the event any statement from the academic fraternity Albia distancing itself from what happened, nor do I, regretfully, accept one in the wake of my letter to you. There is no doubt that I myself, burdened with the defect of Semitism, a word yet unknown at the time of my entry into the fraternity, would not have now applied to the Albia fraternity, nor would I have been accepted today. Under these circumstances, it is clear to any honest person that I would not like to remain a member of the fraternity. I therefore ask you to release me from my membership. And he left, like that. So he was somebody who had thought about Jewish issues. He was somebody who had Jewish pride. But at the time that we meet him, in June of 1895, you can no longer say that he's interested in or proud of his Jewishness. You can only say that he's obsessed. That began, in a sense, in 1891, when his closest friend, not coincidentally a Jew, committed suicide, Heinrich Kanne. Herzl thought about putting everything else aside and writing what he described as a Jewish novel. He ended up not doing so. He came to Paris instead. And as anti-Semitism became more rampant there, just as it was becoming more rampant in his other city, Vienna, he increasingly was thinking about it and writing about it, not only to himself, but especially to his readers in the Neue Freie Presse. In October 1894, he then describes in his diary a particular moment when everything came together. And here's what he writes. I was sitting for the sculptor Baer, who was doing my bust. Our conversation resulted in the insight that it does a Jew no good to become an artist and free himself from the taint of money. The curse still clings. We cannot get out of the ghetto. I became quite heated as I talked, and when I left, my excitement still glowed in me. With the swiftness of that dream involving a pitcher of water in the Arabian fairy tale, the outline of the play came into being. I believe I hadn't gone from the Rue des Combes to the Place Perrière when the whole thing was already finished in my mind. The next day I set to work. 3 blessed weeks of ardor and labor. And what he's describing is his giving birth, actually over the course of 17 days, to his first work devoted exclusively to Jewish causes, The New Ghetto. He did it, by the way, while holding down a very full-time job, filing reports and articles and essays for his own newspaper. And he thought that perhaps he had written it out of his system. But in point of fact, as we'll see, that obsession only grew and grew. So the first thing we have to take away regarding Herzl is he was a man proud of his Judaism and obsessed with the Jewish question, and at this stage in life, obsessed with finding a solution to it. Second thing, we need to look carefully at his education and experiences, as you would with any leader. Right? When Churchill stepped to the fore in May of 1940, he was bringing his vast wealth of knowledge about English history and literature and military affairs and strategic affairs and world history and more. Well, Herzl himself had a very rich foundation that we would do well to pay careful attention to. First of all, he was very well educated in a liberal arts tradition, both in the gymnasium, where he studied for high school, and in law school. He knew German, Hungarian, French, Greek, Latin, and some English. He had legal knowledge, including philosophy of law, but also Roman law, which was very important in terms of the kind of public law that he would need down the road. He was also, on top of everything else, someone who read widely on his own, history, philosophy, literature. He traveled widely throughout Europe, learning about a variety of cultures. He was a very fast writer. He was a very prolific writer. and he wrote in many genres, which meant that in a pinch he could write almost any kind of thing that he might need to write as the leader of a movement. In many ways, though, at least as he describes it, and I think he's right, the key part of his education came politically during those 4 years when he was covering politics in France. And as he puts it, where he learned how the world really works, how decisions are really made, how things really happen. And he was to borrow from that quite liberally during his leadership of the Zionist movement. His background as a playwright also was helpful. Full disclosure, virtually all of his biographers, including those most sympathetic to him, admit that he was at best a workmanlike writer of dramas. But the fact that he was not a great playwright didn't take away from the fact that what he knew how to do was to create a new reality, to create a reality out of his mind and make it real in front of his listeners and in front of his readers. And when you're trying to conjure up, to bring into existence a Jewish state, the real version of which has not been anywhere to be seen in two millennia, that ability to imagine a drama and bring it to life can be rather crucial. I should add, there were plenty of things that he didn't know. He had been very much a lone wolf, right? He was a writer, and as a writer, he worked on his own. He wasn't a boss, he wasn't a manager, he wasn't a leader, at least not during his adult life. So there was a lot he didn't know in those realms. There was also a lot he didn't know about the Jewish world. But interestingly, one of the people who went on to become an opponent of Herzl, but also a sometime ally, Menachem Ussishkin, the fiery Russian Zionist leader, actually saw this as a strength. Right after he met Herzl for the first time, he said the following: "Herzl's greatest deficiency will be his most useful asset. He does not know the first thing about Jews. Therefore, he believes that there are only external obstacles to Zionism, no internal ones. We should not open his eyes to the facts of life so that his faith remains potent." We've talked about Herzl's Jewish background, and we've talked about his stock of knowledge. I want to talk about some of his character traits. He's a very complex person. We can't do him full justice in this short amount of time. But I would point out a few of his traits which are relevant as he sought to deploy his own strengths to the better and as he sought to mask or at least mute the impact of his own weaknesses. First one was, he was ambitious. He wanted to do great things. He wanted to cut a canal in Panama. He wanted to storm the heights of drama. He wanted to be one of the world's leading journalists. He wanted to do world historical things. And you know what? That kind of ambition, which may or may not make you a popular person at cocktail parties or in one-on-ones, can be quite valuable when you're trying to storm a very, very steep hill. Second character trait worth noting is he had a lot of confidence. In fairness, came in waves, he had his moments of doubt, but generally he was confident that he could get things done, achieve the things that he wanted to achieve. And as you're storming that high hill or maybe even pushing a boulder up it, the belief that this really can work can be one of your crucial assets, and Herzl absolutely had that asset. Third thing, he was incredibly hardworking. It's true he traveled, it's true he enjoyed life, but when he was working, which was most of the time, he was working incredibly hard, filing more stories, more essays, more inches of text than just about any other journalist in the European world. And the ability to work hard when striving to achieve something great is often absolutely critical. He also had what would be described today as a manic personality. He could have moments where, beyond his normal baseline of incredibly hard work, he would just shift into a higher gear and just write and think in a frenzy. That's the way that he produced in 17 days during his spare time, The New Ghetto, and that's the way that he was able to have these flurries, frequent flurries, of extraordinary, almost inexplicable productivity. He also had a sense of honor. We saw that sense of honor for himself in becoming somebody who dueled, which is all about honor, but in leaving that dueling fraternity, which was a triumph of an even greater national kind of honor. And this sense of honor was deeply wronged by what he saw happening to Jews around Europe, which for him meant around the world. And if you're going to be a leader, perhaps the single most important character trait you need to have is the sense that something is deeply, terribly wrong, that you, your people, the group that you belong to, have been treated in a way that you just can't tolerate. You can't live with it. You're not going to allow it for one more minute. And Herzl had that. And that was one of the key traits that propelled him towards leadership. Fourth and final area that I want to look at are a few advantages that Herzl had, not so much because of what he had studied and not so much because of his Jewishness and not so much because of his character, but just advantages he was born with or accrued as he went. The first one, which did result from his efforts, was the position that he held at the Neue Freie Presse. We have to understand that from Herzl's point of view and from the point of view of most of the people who met him in his initial stage as a Zionist leader, this was his calling card. Not the fact that he had a dream of a Jewish state, but the fact that he was first he was their Paris correspondent, and after that he was the editor of the Feuilleton section. And to drive this home, I want to use the words of Stefan Zweig, a truly great writer, who wrote the following about that newspaper and that position at that newspaper and that man who held the position. And he wrote it as follows. In Vienna, there was really only one journal of high grade, the Neue Freie Presse, which, because of its dignified principles, its cultural endeavors, and its political prestige, assumed in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy a role not unlike that of the Times in England or the Temps in France. This temple of progress preserved another sacred relic in the so-called Feuilleton. Like the great Parisian dailies such as the Temps and the Journal des Débats, it printed admirable and authoritative essays on poetry, theater, music, and art in the lower half of the front page, separated sharply from the ephemera of politics in the day by an unbroken line that extended from margin to margin. In this space, only the long-established authorities were permitted to express themselves. Sound judgment, the comparative experience of years, and finished artistic form alone could summon an author to this holy place after years of probation. Right? This is putting the newspaper on a pedestal and putting this section on a pedestal. But listen carefully to what Stefan Zweig says about the man himself. The Feuilleton editor of the Neue Freie Presse was Theodor Herzl, and he was the first man of world importance whom I had encountered in my life. Although I did not know how great a change his person was destined to bring about in the fate of the Jewish people and in the history of our time. In other words, forget about the Jewish state, forget about Zionism, forget about the dream, forget about all of that. Herzl was already somebody who was viewed as a force to be reckoned with, a man with a calling card that when you received that calling card, you wanted to meet with the man who stood behind it. That wasn't the only big advantage he brought beyond his Jewish attitudes, his education, and his character. He also had a family arrangement, for better or for worse, whereby he could work 24/7. He was not the prime or even really the secondary caretaker for his children. He lived for months at a time, separated from his wife and from his three children. And whatever that might say about him as a family man, it meant that he could really devote himself, really be all in to the Zionist movement. But not only was he all in, he had his family's money behind him and his wife's family's money, at least somewhat available to him. And when you're starting a movement, you can never tell when you're going to need a sudden influx of capital for this or that initiative. It also, together with his full-time job, enabled him to preserve his absolute independence. He was not dependent on the Zionist movement, didn't accept a salary from the Zionist movement. So the fact that he was born in the family he was born in and married the woman he married made a great difference for his ability to be a leader. And finally, he looked the part. When you saw Herzl, that tall man, that dignified man with those incredible eyes that transfixed not only the listeners who saw him when he spoke to thousands, but those individuals sitting with him in a salon speaking one-on-one, he had the eyes and, of course, he had the beard. And that look, as we'll see, over time becomes significant. This is what Theodor Herzl had going for him as he stepped into a leadership role. And one of the ways you assess leaders, one of the ways to appreciate leadership, is to understand what did a person do with the resources he had, what were the decisions that he made based on those resources and based on this triple daunting challenge, in Herzl's case, the intellectual challenge of establishing a Jewish state, the political challenge, and the diplomatic challenge. What we're going to do over the course of the next five lectures is look at how Herzl, using his strengths, facing the challenges, managed to construct something that at the time seemed literally inconceivable. A Jewish state being reborn after two millennia. And that's where we're going to pick up Herzl the Dreamer in our next lecture.
Dr. Pollisar, in that lecture you described some of Herzl's biographies, some of the myths that other biographers, sometimes aided by Herzl, have told about him. You told us some about the unique qualities of character and courage that allowed him to achieve what Herzl achieved. I wonder, how did he first really hear the call that the Zionist passion, the Zionist mission, was his mission in life? As you just told us, he had so many other avenues of success open to him, and that he heard this calling.
So there wasn't one concrete moment in which he heard the call. What I would say is that over a period of years, from when he first became interested in what he called the Jewish question at age 21, and all the way through until 1894, when he was about 34 years old, he had a growing understanding that he was bound up in the future of this people and wanted to do something about it. He then had a few moments where things really sank in. One of them was while posing for a sculptor who was doing his bust, of all things, and they were discussing anti-Semitism and how even being an artist couldn't get you away from the taint of money. And even though that wouldn't necessarily be the thing that would drive a person in the way that a pogrom would or some epic-making event, that private moment for Herzl set off a chain reaction that led him to write The New Ghetto, about the Jews getting out of the ghetto and living again in the world. So that was the first of these moments.
And how old was he when that happened?
That happened when he was about 34. It was in 1894. There was a moment in early 1895 that had a significant impact, although not as decisive as what many people claim, and that was the degradation of Captain Alfred Dreyfus. The case struck home with Herzl, as with so many others, because Dreyfus was a truly assimilated Jew, a great French patriot, a career officer who devoted himself heart and soul to France. And he was wrongly accused and then wrongly convicted of having been a traitor, but not just any traitor, a traitor who had given French secrets from the French general staff to the arch enemy of France, to the German Empire. And he was convicted. He was then sentenced to exile and to degradation, in which Herzl watched as the buttons of Dreyfus's uniform and the cords of that uniform were ripped off, and his sword, the symbol of his service as an officer, was snapped in two. And seeing that transition from a man who did everything possible to be part of the project of Jewish emancipation, to see that symbol of emancipation be turned into a traitor and cast out because he was a Jew, and overwhelmingly because he was a Jew, that too was a moment. I'll add a third moment, which is when he met with Baron Hirsch and saw Baron Hirsch as the big Jew of money and himself as the Jew of the spirit. Something happened after that meeting when Herzl was just writing down the thoughts, the ones he had shared and especially the ones that he hadn't shared. And it set off a torrent in his mind. He referred to Heinrich Heine as having said that when writing certain verses, he heard the fluttering of eagles' wings. Well, Herzl wrote that he, Herzl, heard the fluttering of eagles' wings while he was writing and while he was developing his ideas. It was as if the idea was trying to work itself out through him, not that he was sitting down in a cold and calculated way to develop it. And he wrote that he would write at night, and he would write in the middle of the night while he was right after getting up from sleeping, and he would write while he was walking, and he would write while he was in the Chamber of Deputies. It was at every moment, from early morning till late at night, he would just be struck by the muse. So that wasn't exactly a moment, but in a sense it was a moment that lasted for a few weeks, in which he worked out almost all of the critical ideas that made up the Jewish state. So I think those were the principal moments. But what's beautiful about Herzl is he really evolved. There wasn't just that one flash of insight. It was constant insight and work, and a new insight and work, and a flash of inspiration, and going back to the grindstone to build this Jewish state.